AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 216 for October 25th, 2013. Will truckers finally love Toyota's new Tundra? Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Mr. DiLorenzo.
John, how are you?
I recognize you.
It's been a while.
You sure look like the guy that's Peter DiLorenzo.
Yeah, I occasionally step in.
And we got Gary Vasilash with us today, too.
John, Peter.
Gary.
How are you guys doing?
Good
to be here.
Yeah, I've been gone. I was in China last week, as you guys know. And
how'd you like it?
Well, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, you guys have heard.
Is that like a blind date and she's, you know, she's got a good personality?
China's only a one-bagger, I guess. But, no, the air pollution, man, that's the thing that is just staggering. Just staggering. I mean, you know, you hear about it, you've read about it, everybody knows about it, and then you go experience, and you go, this is beyond belief. So I was in this city called Wuhan, which I'd never heard of before. It's about an hour flight west of Shanghai. And it's the middle of the steel-making region of China. And the air pollution is staggeringly bad. Just staggering. So when we got in, it was a big mess trying to fly in. So we got in very late at night. So on the way out, I requested a window seat. And, you know, you can't see the end of the runway. I mean, that's how bad the pollution is. And I would estimate, oh, here, Ben's got a video clip up of Wuhan, and you can, you know, so anything that's sort of close by, you can see, but you can notice out in the distance, you know, everything just sort of disappears into the haze.
So that was actually a sunny day, but
yeah, you can. No, that's right. If you see your shadow, that's a sunny day. I mean, but anyway, as I'm saying, we're flying out of this place, and I would estimate it wasn't until we got to 20,000 feet that we got up above the smog layer, and we must have flown for an hour before it started to dissipate, where you could see the ground again. And I'm telling you, they have an environmental crisis on their hands, and that makes me wonder, this has got to impact the auto industry. I mean, how can, they're on a tear right now, they're going to build 20 million cars, and or certainly sell 20 million vehicles in China.
Well, China just banned cars over 15 years old, you know. And the collectors are going nuts. So they have to bring them out at certain hours where no one's around, and because they're trying to eliminate cars older than 50 years for emission control.
Yeah, I'm not sure that'll put much of a dent in it.
No, it won't.
I mean, they've got a full-blown crisis, and I got to believe, you know, this keeps playing out for a while. They're going to have to say, hey, enough of all this car stuff. This is, we're going to die from it.
Well, it's.
And it's not just cars.
No, it's the biggest generator of it is the coal.
Right.
Power. That's where it is.
That's right. And so where I was, they make a lot of steel. Obviously, they use right. a lot of coal to make the steel.
But think about it. It's sort of a vicious circle that, you know, you're burning the coal to make the steel. You're making the steel to make the cars. You're making the cars to get more steel, you're making more steel to get more coal, and, you know, so it's just one thing that this...
Well, the push to electric cars there, it's not going to sell anything.
It's not going to happen. In fact, Volkswagen announced while we were there, they're not going to sell an electric car in China. A, they know they're not selling, so they're going to go the plug-in route. And but I think that's a pretty significant statement. You know, Volkswagen brand is the biggest brand in China. And when the biggest brand says, forget it, you know, we're not going to do an electric car.
And they just opened another plant there today.
Today?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that one will build some plug-ins.
It's like some phenomenal number. They have like 105 plants in the around the world. It's just
so they're talking
staggering.
20 million annual sales?
20 million annual sales this year. And they think by the end of the decade, it could be up to 30 million a year.
There's gold in them there hills.
That's a lot of cars. Mm-hmm. You know, that's now you're talking the U.S. and Europe put together. You know, that's how big it is. But again, if they've got this pollution problem, and I'm telling you, I don't know how the people there put up with it. I just don't. And there's going to be a day when they're just going to put their foot down. And
well, one would assume that the government would keep things tamped down sufficiently well.
With shock troops and truncheons, you bet.
I mean, when it's rolling in on the tarmac on the airports and getting on the international news, it's pretty hard to cover up. And the coal-fired plants, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what they rely on.
Sure.
So I thought that was pretty interesting. That's my big takeaway, is that this pollution problem, at some point they're going to have to do something with the automotive industry there and the coal plants and, you know, a whole bunch of things. Restaurants are another big source. So, but, you know, for the sake of this show, I'll say it's worth talking about because I believe it's going to have an impact on the auto industry.
Well, and one would assume that with that many cars, this means that much more gasoline is required. And,
right.
You know, given that it's a world market for petroleum, that we'll see those 20 million cars every time we go fill up our cars at the station. And that will begin to increase regardless of whether we use less or not, because there'll be other parts of the world where they're using a hell of a lot more.
That's right.
Well, the precious metal thing, controlled by China.
Sure.
Yeah, the rare earth metals, Yeah, that's something they've got a lock on. But anyway, enough about China. What else have you guys been doing?
I've been, so Peter, last week you guys talked a lot about Tesla, and today they made an announcement that they hired a guy named Doug Field from Apple
to be their director of product programs.
And
on the same day, the analyst in New York says it's worth $45 a share.
And where is it right now, share?
It's like a hundred and something, but it's totally ridiculous, overpriced.
So this guy is, so I was telling John earlier, he's a true believer. This guy worked at Ford, was in the auto industry, and left Ford and went to MIT and got another degree, and then went into the healthcare industry for a while because he wanted to try something else. And I the name just rang a bell with me, and I didn't know why. And I had actually interviewed this guy and did a story on him. And so I printed it out and was reading it, and this guy, it's just absolutely astonishing. And so just, this is a quote from him. Products need stewardship. They need ownership. When responsibility for making a product great is distributed across organizations and people, products very quickly lose their soul. And his whole thing is about that individuals who know a lot are the ones who ought to make decisions, not people who are high up in organizations. Sound like an organization that you might be familiar with? And, you know, and he's saying, and here's another quote from him, if you have an environment where it is a career dead end to have your product canceled, then every incentive in the company is going to line up around making a product successful in the survival of the fittest system, which means it's not going to be that innovative. So it'll be covering your ass, not creating great product. And I'm thinking, this guy gets it. So, you know, he'd gone to Segway, and, you know, even though that was a horrible marketing failure, it's a technological tour de force. I mean, that thing is just an amazing, amazing thing. I mean, nobody needs one, but be that as it may. But the engineering squad, and so it just seemed to me that what an interesting thing that he's going to Tesla.
When did he go to Apple?
After he left Segway. So he's been there for, I think, 4 or 5 years now. And so the new MacBook Air is under him, and so
is he going to run this new small car that Elon?
He's in charge of
all
product. So he's vice president of all product development there. So now, admittedly, one guy's not going to make a company, but you know, it was still striking to me that this guy seems to be so dialed in terms of his approach to engineering and his approach to product development, that, you know, more guys like that are needed in this industry. And, you know, and so, you know, where does he go? He goes to Tesla. Now, if you go to Apple, then he's just, you know, Tesla's basically down the street, so probably didn't want to add to his.
They probably gave him a bunch of stock.
Yeah. But, so I thought that was an interesting development.
Yeah, it is.
Interesting.
You know, I stand in awe of what Tesla has achieved, not their stock price, because I think that's kaflooey. I think,
that's,
you know, total, that's a
felon. Totally bogus.
Right. But the car is awesome. And, but I'm not willing to say that Tesla has totally proved itself yet.
No,
I want to see 2-3 more years of it actually making a profit.
Sure.
Because, as you guys know, it's making money solely on selling credits right now, which is legit. I don't have any problem with that. But they're not making money on operations, mm-hmm. and that's got to change. So, look, they only have one car out. When they get the second crossover, that's going to help enormously for them. But, you know, until they make money on operations for several years in a row, then I'll be a believer.
Ford announced today they made some money. That was nice to see.
They did, but their profit was down. They took a big charge, almost $500 million.
Right. Part of that was Europe, and what was the other part?
The other was early retirement for U.S. Yeah. retirees. And so, I mean, look, Daimler sold 1 million fewer cars than Ford did, but brought in $4 billion more in revenue.
That's why a luxury brand is so important.
So important.
And that's why Ford has to stay the course on Lincoln. They can't walk away.
Right.
So we won't know, and the normal civilians out there will not acknowledge that Lincoln exists until the full-size Lincoln, the new one, hits the streets. That's when people will register, oh, that's a Lincoln. So if that car is anything less than, oh, my God, did you see that Lincoln? They're in trouble. That car has to be stunning. It has to play in the Cadillac design, GM design field, league.
Because no
GM
question.
Design is, to me...
Well, where did Max Wolf come from? Oh, that's right, Cadillac design.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting looking at, you know, since they were doing financials, and so there's the, you know, the fine print, the risk factors that they must put in there. And so I don't know. I mean, I haven't traveled for a couple of weeks, and so I'm reading risk factors in these things.
And there were
2 points that really surprised me in that. And so, you know, they're talking about what could affect, you know, their financial future. And so this is lower than anticipated market acceptance of Ford's newer existing products. Okay. The point right after that, market shift away from sales of larger, more profitable vehicles beyond Ford's current planning assumption, particularly in the United States.
Yeah.
I think that's very interesting that there's a concern that, you know, that they could be shifting away, which would leave them going like, oops.
So, yeah. There go the big profit makers.
Well, let's face it. I mean, selling trucks, that's where it's at.
Yeah,
that's the franchise of Ford.
So I was at Ford earlier this week with Hao Tai-Tang, who runs their purchasing operations.
Hao's been on this show.
He's been on the show. He's a hardcore car enthusiast.
Hardcore car guy.
And so to me, it's very interesting that they put him in charge of purchasing. Clearly, they're grooming him for better things down the road. But what he pointed out is that, you know, Ford and all the automakers and suppliers in North America are pretty much straining at the seams right now, trying to meet demand. And so when you start offering options and build combinations, that can have a really big impact on suppliers. It can choke them. So they're sending out teams now as they study options and things like that. They're sending teams out to suppliers to evaluate how this might impact their manufacturing operations. And this is a classic argument, you know, do you offer all these colors and interior trim combinations, whatnot, or do you try to simplify the manufacturing process as much as possible? And Gary, you follow this sort of thing.
Right.
Where do you follow?
Well, I mean, it strikes me that if we go back, let's say, 10 years, okay, it was approximately at that point where we saw the big three domestic companies all paying attention to what companies like Toyota were doing in terms of simplification and the way that they would option vehicles, that they would be providing specific packages rather than, you know, a Chinese menu approach of, you know, one from here, one from here, one from here. And so they began to radically simplify as they moved into to lean operations, right? And so, you know, you had that simplification, and then I think what you ended up having was this reaction of like, well, gee, maybe what we ought to do is we ought to compete on being able to tailor products more specifically to customer demand, which then automatically begins to add complexity to what you're doing. And I mean, just think of an example of the Dart. I mean, how they're saying that you can basically have that and, you know.
Yeah, well, that's a train wreck. How'd that work out?
Well, but I'm just saying that's an exact, you know, representation of this sort of thing when you try to do too much. Now, I think the danger might be that they pull back too far and they get to the point where, you know, you can have any color you want as long as it's black. You know, so where did that come from, right? And, you know, I'm a little leery of this thing of, you know, Ford sending out teams to suppliers, because it is my sense that suppliers are perhaps better than a lot of these companies are, because, you know, they're the ones doing it. But they're on the knife edge, you know what I mean? It's like these guys really are watching their P's and Q's. And I think that they've gone through, you know, leaning out their systems, getting a better control over their systems than most of the auto manufacturers have still. And so it'd be like, you know, we're from the government and we're here to help you sort of thing. You know, we're from Ford, we're here to see whether you can do your job or not. I don't know. But he also announced that they're going to reduce the number of suppliers, which adds another strain on the existing suppliers. Because, I mean, if these guys are doing a lot of work right now, you're going to say, oh, here's some more, you know. Thank you, sir. May I have another?
I mean, he made some good points. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but like the top 65 suppliers account for, I can't remember the number, 70% of all the volume. And, you know, by the end of the decade, they're going to account for 99% of the volume as Ford reduces platforms and powertrain variations. So I'm not sure that it's going to be so much more of a strain. It will be a whole lot more volume, and there will be some strain because of that. But it's not necessarily going to add a whole lot more complexity.
Well, I would be interested. I haven't looked. I don't recall how Ford scored on the John Hanke's supplier survey.
Right.
And because, I mean, you know, you had Toyota and Honda up here, and then you had like everybody else sort of down here. And even though these guys, I remember last year for sure that like these guys went down like this much, and it was like, oh, what a horror. You know, they've gone down that much, and these guys had like inched up this much. So, you know, unless they have superb supplier relationships, they could be in for a world of hurt. I mean, and that might be in one of these risk factors that they're going forward, because, you know, if the supplier doesn't like you very much and is doing things just because you're saying, I'm the customer, damn it, and you will like me, it'll work out so well.
Right.
I'm driving an Audi A8 L TDI.
It's awesome.
It is. Stickers for $99,000. Doesn't have the cold weather package for $99,000. And, you know,
they know how to ding you for everything.
I know a lot of people don't live in cold
climate. It was 31 degrees this morning, so.
I know a lot of
those
people
who are not in Detroit who should know that.
A lot of people who watch and listen to the show aren't in hot or cold weather, but believe me, no heated steering wheel.
What?
No, it doesn't have a cold weather package or something. It's not on there. I looked.
That's unreal.
It's $99,000. Any rate, I mean, hey, it's beautiful. Technically, the motor, everything, it's just seamless. I mean, the thing is great. It's got 240 horsepower, but it's got 408 or 6 foot-pounds of torque. So it feels like a V8 easily. But, and it's an AA, which is gorgeous inside. But the thing feels like there's a boat anchor in front. I mean, it's
just so much weight up.
Oh man, it is so sluggish. And you know, I drove normally a regular gasoline A8, and I loved it like you did.
Mm-hmm.
But this would be a real commitment to get this car. I mean, the mileage is notable. I think it's 2436 or something. Maybe that's high, but I don't know. It's so sluggish. The motor isn't sluggish, but the car is sluggish.
Yeah.
I mean, it just feels heavy. And
it's a heavy car to begin with.
Yeah,
I can imagine.
And driving around town, it just feels
ponderous.
So,
yeah,
that's a feature. The ponderous thing that you know you've arrived and now you just.
I mean,
go
if you, I mean, yeah, driving around in your normal urban 3/10, which is about what it is, I guess it's fine. Or just putting it on the freeway and setting the cruise at 80, it's fine. But man, it is ponderous and heavy, and you know.
Meanwhile, I'm driving a Mazda 3 5-door. I like this car a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a good,
very simple, very straightforward, very basic. You know, they just tried to take all the weight out. They tried to do everything very basically, very well. You know, it passed my 100-yard test. You know, within 100 yards, I went, damn, this is a good car. I've got the manual. I haven't driven the automatic yet, so I'll totally withhold.
Well,
the
I've driven them both, and you know, but you know, to your point that they've made it very simple, and they, but I mean it. You're not sacrificing. I mean, you're in the car, and it's a nice interior. I mean, they did a great job. I think that they've really upped their ante on that. Because the last generation, interior plastics and things like that were not so good. But on this one, I think they've done a superb job, and they, you know, paid attention to what they needed to.
And the infotainment stuff, it's very intuitive, very easy to use. You know, I didn't have to read the manual.
Right. I just got out of an Encore. And so I had to go to a place, a country club in Commerce Township last night, and I had no idea where this was. I was in my driveway for 10 minutes trying to put it in the navigation system, and I finally just went in and got my $200 Garmin, and beep, 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 good to go. So how idiotic is this? I've got the Garmin stuck to the windshield right above the 7-inch color screen, you know, that I couldn't program. I mean, and it was exactly my thinking. That you shouldn't need to read the manual.
Right.
You shouldn't have to look at those things.
That's what we here at the shop call an RTFM problem. Read the effing manual.
Oh. Yeah, it's just crazy. I mean, especially, I mean, that consumer electronics have become so intuitive to use. That shouldn't automakers have sort of gotten that by now?
No, because They stumble over themselves. They outthink it.
They do.
They want to. If it's not invented here, then they have to invent it inside. Even though there's a supplier down the street who could get them up and running in like a couple days. But no, we're going to learn it. We're gonna deep into it, and we're gonna own it. And then by the time they're done, they're 3 years late, and they're about 80% more costly. I don't understand it. The car companies are still doing it today. Still doing it today. There's examples of it at every car company throughout the business. It's just like, well, we're gonna, that's cool and everything, but we're gonna do it. What do you mean you're gonna do it? It's better over there.
Sure.
And they'll sell it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can integrate it and put your label on it and it's all good. No.
Well, you're mentioning, John, about how Sid Mead was saying that we're not going to own cars in 10 years anyway, so
yeah.
It's really not
going to matter. Yeah, we did a TV show with Sid Mead, and that's what he was saying with all this car sharing that's going on and more people using car sharing. He said to buy a car and finance it for years or lease it for years with all these payments, and it spends most of its existence parked.
Well,
he said that's not an economic model that's going to
work. Clearly, there's a clear demarcation for a certain age group that's fading in the sunset. It's affecting racing. It's affecting the whole car enthusiasm thing. And, you know, it's not good. I mean, I wrote my column on basically NASCAR is going to shoot themselves in the head eventually, and IndyCar already has. And racing's in crisis in this country, and you go to the vintage races and it's awesome, but everyone's got gray hair.
Right.
I mean, there are some kids there, but it's just this car thing, as we know it, could be, you know, in the sunset.
But isn't it sort of interesting that if you're in Europe and you're walking down a street on a Sunday or something, and you'll see a big crowd of people, and they're all watching a TV set with a Formula One race on it.
Well,
and I mean,
they're still enthusiastic.
But there's so many of them there.
I get
that. And if
you
look at it here, and I wonder what
we have a whole generation of young people who really just don't give a shit about cars. And you know, what do all these car companies spend all their time on? How do we reach them? You know, I mean, advertising has become secondary. Now marketing has become, well, what is our social media play? What's the run-up to when we run the spots? And what are we doing social media-wise during the spots and after the spots? To the point of spots an afterthought. It's all based on, getting buzz, generating buzz, getting response. I just like to, and you still run into kids who are excited as hell. About
sure, there's plenty of them, but it doesn't, you know, permeate society as it did when we were growing.
Not at all.
Not even close.
Not even close.
And the trend is only going to continue.
Yeah. And I don't know about Sid Mead saying, you know, we're all going to be driving share. No, I don't believe that's going to happen. But I think in urban centers, things are going to get.
Yeah, well, I think he's onto something in the urban centers where people will no longer buy a car. They'll just pay for the use of one when they need it. And by the way, when they need it, they seem to like going for premium brands. I mean, if you only have to pay for a car a couple of hours a week, why not be in a BMW? That's kind of what's coming out of this car sharing stuff.
Yeah, well, that's
some of the lessons learned.
That's not a long-term sustainability model for the car companies.
No.
It just isn't.
Right.
So.
Well, the other thing to think about is that, okay, you know, you own your car and you have your stuff in your car and your car has the level of cleanliness or what have you in your car, right? Now, if you're very fastidious and the guy who had the car before you was a pig,
spilled a half a cup of venti latte on your console.
Yeah. And so who's going to be responsible for cleaning that?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, because there's been a pushback that Zipcar has discovered that a whole lot of people are really unhappy with
how dirty it is.
Right. So,
well, because no one's accountable.
Right.
No one takes care of it.
Well, because it's not part of their model. But think about it from this point of view. I mean, so you say, okay, people would want to get a BMW because you're going to only have it for a couple hours, right? Well, so a BMW is not only its driving performance, it's also the amenities inside the cabin, right? I mean, so it's got nice leather, it's got, you know, just beautiful instrumentation. So if we're going to go to a society whereby the cars are meant to be shared, you're going to have to completely change the materials on the inside of the car. You're going to have to completely change the interfaces, the knobs, the buttons, and everything else.
There may be a pocket of acceptance for this, but I don't think it's going to be big. I really don't. I guess people are just going to push back. Let me ask you something. Do you remember way back in Neanderthal age or whatever, when they used to have kids' safety schools and kids used to, they'd lay out city streets, stop signs, and kids be in their pedal cars. And
I remember that.
I mean, that's what happened back then. So that's why when kids were about 12, I said, man, I can't wait to drive. Now, kids are driven around until they're like 23. You know, they have to say, hey, Jed, you going to get a driver's license when you say, well, why? You drive me around. Or Bobby drives me around. Someone drives me around. Isn't that the way the world works? No, not really. You get a job and, you know, you go to work for a gaming company. How are you going to get there? Oh, I guess I'll have to drive. Yeah, that means you have to get a license. But, that whole compelling, I can't wait to get my license. I think it's in rural areas, it's still huge.
Mm-hmm.
Are you kidding? I just want to get out of this one dog town as soon as I can. But, you know, urban centers, it's their iPads
That's
and
right.
iPhones. I mean, they sleep with them at night.
Hey, good time to take a break, and let's get our guest, Mike Swears from Toyota, in here. But, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Mike Swears, great to have you on AutoLine After Hours.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate to be here.
Welcome, Mike. What is that thing in the studio? That's a big-ass truck.
That's our new 2014 Tundra.
That's, wow, that's the 1794 baby. Edition?
That is a 1794 edition.
And what is there's significance to 1794? I've read it. And what is it again?
1794 was the year that the oldest ranch in Texas was established. And that's the ranch that our plant is on. Okay. So we're really paying up to the heritage of our plant in the land and the significance of that.
Yeah, so a lot of people may not know that the plant, the one and only plant in the world that builds these things, is in Texas.
That's correct.
South of San Antonio, correct?
South of San Antonio. We're the only truck built in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the chief engineer on this thing.
I am.
And you started, what, from scratch on this truck? Or how much is carryover from the prior model?
We did carry over some. A lot of the underpinnings are carryovered. We did go in and modify our secondary dampening on our springs. We changed our shock absorbers and the valving in our shock absorbers to improve our ride comfort. But our powertrain, for the most part, is carryover. Steering's been redone to improve our steering as well. We retained the hydraulic steering versus going to EPS. That's a personal choice of mine, but
you don't need it yet, in other words.
Yeah.
Because everybody seems to be doing it for fuel economy, not because the consumer says, oh, I need electric power steering.
Well, yeah, we have not had a consumer ask for it. And quite honestly, we build a lot of EPS, electric power steering units. Mainly when you have hybrids, you have to have the electric power steering. But in a truck where you're towing or where you're having to back up a trailer or where you get into situations where you're off-road, knowing where those wheels are real important. And we've gone all over the world with our truck, four-wheeling. We pride ourselves in our off-road heritage. So, making sure that customer can continue to do the things he's done with Toyota trucks. And globally, we build a lot of trucks that do go off-road. And Tacoma, which I'm also responsible for, that customer base does take our truck off-road. So we want to make sure that those customers' expectations are met. And when we look at the EPS unit, it does improve fuel economy. Will the customer ever realize the fuel economy savings? Absolutely not. So the real question is, why is it being introduced?
So you just like the feel of having a shaft directly to the steering.
Yeah, the road input is there. You know what your front end is doing, what your truck is doing. And like I said, when you're backing up, especially a gooseneck trailer or a fifth wheel trailer, being able to tell where those front wheels are, being able to feel the ground beneath you is real important.
So you have an interesting strategy in terms of powertrain.
I was just going to bring that up.
You guys, the other guys are making, a lot of hay about different technological solutions that they have. And you guys have basically stayed the course. Why is that?
Well, if I look at my powertrain, when I introduced this engine in 2007.
What is it again? Give us the...
This is a 5.7 liter, right, double overhead cam, 32 valve VVT engine. And when we introduced it, it was the most advanced engine on the market in trucks. And I'm happy to say today it's still one of the most advanced engines on the market. We did make a few changes to improve efficiency of the engine. We haven't made a big thing about that, just from the simple fact that we didn't change our horsepower on the engine. But we feel we have a very capable powertrain, that powertrain that's in there, and married with our six-speed transmission meets our durability. And again, QDR is very important to us. So that quality, that durability, that reliability is first and foremost important to us and for our customers. So, you know, as an example of that, as I was at our marketing side in California, and I had to go down to the plant, and I took a red eye from LAX down to San Antonio, and I got in about 1 in the morning. I jump on the rent-a-car shuttle, and the shuttle driver sees my Toyota coat, and he says, "Oh, do you work for Toyota?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "What do you do?" I said, "Well, I'm in charge of the Tundra and Tacoma." And he says, "Really?" He says, "I have a 2006 Tundra with 532,000 miles on it." And I go, "Wow." And he goes, "And I have a 2001 Tacoma," he says, "and that has 756,000 miles on it." He goes, "That one I just got out of the shop." I said, "Really?" I said, "What was wrong with it?" He said, "I had my second clutch put in." I go, "Your second clutch?" And he says, "Yeah, why? Is that bad?" I'm like, no, we designed them to last that long. But, you know, our customers wear that mileage like a badge of honor. We had some complaints because our odometers on some of our vehicles only went up to 299,999. And that customer is waiting for it to hit 300,000.
And it never does.
And we were getting complaints in the call center, you know. What happened? Why did my odometer stop? And we said, "Well, we'll put a new one in." "Well, I don't want a new one. I want it to keep going." And so, you know, really it gets back to our heritage, our QDR, and we want to ensure that whatever we put in our trucks has that type of reliability, that durability in it. And we believe our engine does that.
And you said to me at another venue that you want to make sure the consumer would see the consequence of making a change, that the consumer would actually derive value, and that you didn't believe that adding certain things to the powertrain would necessarily turn into that.
Well, absolutely. You know, truck customers, the number one reason they buy a truck is capability. But they're very savvy customers. They're looking for that bargain. And they will pay money. You know, one of our competitors said they haven't seen the ceiling for pickup truck price yet. And with this truck, our penetration on 1794 in our Platinum is at 25% of our market rate, our mix right now.
And that's the most expensive one you've
got. That's the most expensive one we have. Hmm. And it was shocking to us. But, again, they want something in return. They'll pay the money, but they want something in return. And we looked at cylinder deactivation. We looked at start-stop technology. And combined, they're about 1.5% improvement in fuel economy. But it's very expensive technology. They're not going to see a return on that investment. So as we looked at what can we do to improve fuel economy, and we looked at what our competitors are doing and some of the feedback the market is giving on them, and even some of what the media has done in testing, you know, if I compare my 3UR, my 5.7U engine to a V6 turbo, you know, looking at combined fuel economy, some of the media outlets and testing outlets like Consumer Reports comes back and says the combined fuel economy for both trucks is 15 miles a gallon. And when you look at the return, if the customer is going to pay $1,000 more for that technology, are they going to see $1,000 in return for the fuel economy? And the answer is no. So my question really is, why are they doing it? Is it for the customer or is it for the company?
It's for the label, because that's how people shop. You know, the fuel economy label, and if you can eke out even one more mile per gallon, everybody beats their chest and brags to the world about it.
And that's true. That's absolutely true. And a lot of emphasis has been put on highway fuel economy. We're a little bit different again. I've been at Toyota for almost 24 years now. And, you know, our model's always been to under-promise and over-deliver. And when we consider areas like that, the main thing is, are you giving the customer what the customer wants and desires? And our powertrain, our drive ratios, our final drive ratio is based on really that combined fuel economy. We try to set up our powertrain so that the customer is actually going to see what we're promising, not this very high highway that we've tuned to an EPA cycle, but actually in daily driving, if we're promising 18, you're going to see 18. And, you know, our customers do come back and say, "Well, I would love to have more fuel economy." But they also don't come back and say, "Well, I'm really disappointed that I was expecting this big number and this is what I'm getting."
So you have a new transmission in the works for this?
We're always looking at new technology.
I'll take that as a yes, Peter.
Yeah.
But when we find that right mix for the customer and we can guarantee the reliability, we'll introduce.
Well, it's not just the customer, though, right? Because, I mean, fuel economy standards are going to force you into doing things, even if the customer doesn't ask.
Lighter materials. Carbon fiber doors.
That would.
Yeah, I bet that worked really well on a pickup truck out on a farm somewhere.
Yeah.
And it is difficult. You know, in some of the events that I've done, one of the things that I'm asked is, you know, what's happening in the future? Well, I think come 2025, I don't know if anybody knows what a pickup's going to look like at that point because of the regulations.
Right.
But, you know, this truck right here and what we've done with the truck is really going after the voice of the customer. And
speaking of the voice of the customer, we got Chip with a camera inside the vehicle right now. Ben, maybe you can bring up on the screen what Chip is showing, and Mike, maybe you can walk us through a little bit of the interior and what you put in there for your customer.
I would love to. And this is our 1794 model, as
it's
I
like
mentioned before. Funny you said that, because the leather in this vehicle is the same as we put in the LS. So this is our Shelf 2 leather.
Wow.
This is top-of-the-line leather. This was a little bit painful for me as we went out, and I became chief engineer for the Tundra because I used to be VP of interior design. So when you all wrote that our interiors look too plasticky, it really was kind of a dagger in my heart. So for the 1794, the Platinum, which are two completely different feels of trucks, this is more of our Western theme. We have ultra suede inserts in the seats. We have the Shelf 2 leather. There's leather on the IP. There's leather on the door trims. And again, we wanted to emphasize, you know, the hand, the materials, the craftsmanship, the colors, the textures that the customer is really interacting with. So what he feels, what he sees, what he touches, as he's bought up to our premium truck, he realizes that he's getting something for his money. Again, going back to that, if they're willing to pay more money, then they should get something special.
What's this sticker for, by the way?
That truck right there is about $49,000. And then in the rear of the vehicle, we changed the rear seat. And again, this was a little bit painful for me. We used to have a slide recline seat in our Crew Max. And we went out and did a customer survey because I heard some complaints from our current customer about the rear seat, the slide recline. And 88% of our customers came back and said they'd rather have the same seat that's in the double cab that tips up so they had more storage back there. The slide recline seat was my idea, so it was really painful to kind of get that very blatant feedback. But again, I was reminded of a story that Akio Toyota said directly to me when I was in charge of interiors when he became president. We had this thing where we always emphasized our wow items. How are we going to wow the customer, give them something special? And his comment to me was, quit giving the customer what you think is cool, and actually give them what they're asking for. So this is a result of, again, listening to the voice of the customer and making sure the customer is getting what they need, and what they need is more storage back there.
I tell you, those flip-up seats in the back and all the pickups now, I love them. It's so convenient.
And it's easy. It's one-hand operation. They're balanced so that they'll go up and lock into place with very little effort. So, again, you can unlatch it with the same hand lifted up if you have something you need to put back there so you're not having to set it down and pick it back up again.
So to the point of the customer, so when you're engineering this vehicle, who are you thinking about in terms of who is going to want this compared to another product from someone else?
You know, we went back and we have our own customer base, but about 27% of our customer base is Conquest customers. So going out and really hearing the customer's voice themselves and going to truck country like down in Texas and asking them. So we asked our customers, we asked Conquest customers, we've asked our competitors' customers. Part of the change to the chiseled styling, the more traditional rugged styling of the truck came from a competitor's customer. And we were doing a market clinic, and we had all the trucks up on a stage, and I was behind the two-way glass, and the moderator asked him, he says, what do you think about the Tundra? And he says, it's too small. And I'm standing behind this glass, and we have the biggest truck on the stage. You know, our truck is 79.9 inches. I can't make it any bigger, right? It's, to regulation, it is the biggest truck out there.
And the moderator, it's 79 to the edge of the mirrors or 79?
79 to the edge of the over fender. So to the fender itself at the wheel. And the moderator asked him, he says, well, all the trucks look about the same size. Why do you say it's too small? And he came back and he said, it's too round. It's too bubbly. It doesn't look like, you say it's a really tough truck. You say it has this capability, but it doesn't look like it can do what you're saying it can do. And that was a good takeaway for us to go back and what is our truck customer asking for? And then part of it is my own experience. So I've driven trucks since I could drive. And I've owned basically everybody's trucks from compact up to one-ton trucks. I'm an old farm boy, so understanding what I would desire in a truck as well. Some of the changes on this truck are 7-4-pin connector in the back. I have actually, it used to be mounted underneath the bumper. I bent that out in the field doing hay, and I went in and work, and I grabbed the bumper engineer, and I took him outside, and I said, we need to fix this. So he wrote an engineering change, and he put a bigger bracket in there, and then I was ditch loading a snowmobile. I don't know if you know what that is, but I backed down into the ditch, and I rolled the snowmobile up in the back, and I came back, and I bent it again. So we were working on this truck, and I took him back out in the parking lot, and I said, this needs to change, completely needs to change location. So they moved it up. And the great thing about design and working with engineers that are highly motivated and really want to build a great product is the engineer came back and said, you know, we moved the location, but we also changed the license plate lamp. And with this new license plate lamp, it performs better than the old one, but it also lights that 7-4-pin connector. So at night, you can see the connector. And I'm like, well, that's a great idea, you know. So getting them motivated, and they're highly motivated, and having them pay attention to the small details, my hope is that our customer understands that if we can pay attention to the small details, we'll pay attention to the big details.
And didn't you redesign the rear bumper entirely and make that into...
Yeah, another personal story, but we grow about 170 acres of hay, and I have high school kids working for me, and I put three bumpers on my own truck. And I was not happy with that situation and went in and told them, we really need to gauge up this bumper. I think if I breathed heavy on the bumper, I could dent it, is I think my exact words to them. And they went back and studied it, and they came back and said, okay, we increased the gauge of the steel. But we have a different idea, and they put a truss design underneath it. So not only is it stronger, you know, in an impact, but it's also stronger when you're stepping on top of it. And then they came back and said that we also went out and we studied where people damage their bumpers, and we went out to and looked at everybody's pickups and at marinas. We looked at them at RV parks. We looked at, you know, people's trucks in the parking lot. And we analyze where they damage it most. And our proposal to you is, let's change it to a three-piece bumper. So if you damage a portion of your bumper,
great idea.
You only need to replace the part you damaged. And the black resin part on the back is the area that gets damaged the most, and that's the lowest cost part to replace. And again, you know, I had to give them a big pat on the back. We have some pretty clever guys working for us, and told them that, yeah, you know, what a wonderful idea. And instead of replacing the whole bumper, you just replace that section.
That's pretty cool. Hey, we've got a bunch of questions coming in here, so why don't we get to that part of it? Ben, let's get to rapid fire. No explosion. Okay. So, we've got a bunch of questions here for you, Mike. David Malinovsky says, does Toyota have plans to have optional rear-end ratios for the Tundra?
You know, we have a 3.9 and a 4.10 and a 4.3 currently. Again, looking at some of the final drive ratios of our trucks, they're calibrated to get the best combined fuel economy. And with our final drive ratios, we're really focusing on the lower end, getting out of the hole, where maybe some of our competitors have gone to smaller rear ends to focus on highway or a better final drive ratio. But we really try to tune the powertrain again, focusing on that combined. So as we look at powertrain changes in the future, yeah, we'll probably have different options as we look at transmission and drive ratio changes.
JM1NB, I guess this is to me, says, how much did you have to censor yourself on the video reports from China? Didn't have to censor myself at all. You know, in China, you can say whatever the hell you want to say, as long as it doesn't have anything to do with the Communist Party. If you want to talk about anything else that's going on, you can pretty much say whatever the hell you want. But if you want to start talking about the government, the party, really, yeah, I wouldn't do it there.
Guess who's not going back?
Right. Let's see. Joe Yannarelli via Twitter says, Peter, you recently sang the praises of the VW GTI. Have any of you sampled the new one? Or was that the new one that you had?
No, that's not the new one, but it's coming. Not yet.
Yeah, I haven't.
I drove the GTD, but that was the diesel version.
Yeah, so. Yeah. No, I haven't been in that either. Okay, Abhi Kumar says, I'd like to know, between Honda, Nissan, and Toyota pickup trucks, why is it that only Toyota is number one in that competitive set? What happened to Honda and Nissan trucks? And he also wants to know why trucks don't have CVT transmissions. I think you can answer that pretty quickly there, Mike.
Well, you know, a lot of the competitors went out of the compact truck market. Our approach to compact trucks may be a little bit different than our competition was in the past and currently is. But, you know, the CVT issue for trucks, we haven't really had anybody asking for CVT in that area. And again,
could you make it durable enough to be in a pickup like this?
I don't know. We haven't tried. I can't really answer that question because we haven't tried to do it. You know, but again, looking at what our customers use their compact trucks, and a compact truck customer is a completely different demographic than a full-size truck customer. And what they do with their trucks is completely different. So, you know, a full-size truck customer may take, like this truck, they may take off the road, and their off-roading isn't so severe. We changed our transmission case in this, our transfer case in this truck to beef it up a little bit to make it shift a little bit faster. But when I compare that to like a Tacoma, that Tacoma customer actually goes out and purchases that very high-end truck, and they're going off-road, and they're climbing rocks with it. So the durability and making sure that transmission can do what they're asking it to can do is really important.
We got a couple of Tacoma questions. Rum and Coke wants to know, what's the future for Tacoma? And he wants to know, why can Toyota make a case for a smaller pickup when others cannot?
I can't answer that question about making a case for it. Right now, we're enjoying the lion's share of the market. We were 67% last month. But truly, the Tacoma customer is a very dedicated customer. When they come in looking for a Tacoma, you're not going to talk them in or out of a Tacoma. They're coming in specifically to buy that truck. But making the case for it and what we're going to do in the future, again, we're looking to what we need to do in the future to retain that market and how we can make a better truck.
You got GM coming back with Colorado, though, so
correct.
There will be some more competition.
Right. Competition
is
coming.
And Nissan's there with the Frontier.
And Nissan's there with the Frontier. So, you know, competition is coming. The market looks like it's going to stabilize about 300,000 units is our estimation. Talking to some of my buddies at GM, they're a little more optimistic about the market than we are. But, you know, again, as regulations come in, as CAFE requirements increase, that market's going to change slightly, and I think there may be some growth in that market for customers who are looking for more MPGs.
And Mike DeWight says, will the Tacoma be merged with those other little trucks that Toyota sells around the world?
At this time, there's no plan for that. We have, again, a great following for Tacoma, and making sure that our truck meets the durability and quality requirements. And actually, the taste of that customer in North America is real important to us.
Is he referring to the Hilux? Isn't that the name of the others?
Yes, I would be guessing that he's referring to the Hilux, which is sold over.
And that's
overseas.
Quite different from the Tacoma, is it?
Yeah, that's based for, you know, for countries, undeveloped countries. So the durability requirements are different than what we put into the Tacoma.
Hey, we've got a number of phone calls here. Ben, let's bring one of them in.
Hi, it's Paul Walker calling from Katy, Texas. I've got one of these Toyota Tundras. It's a good truck. I was getting into a bit of a discussion with a guy that had a Chevy about the horsepower ratings. And anyway, he produced this story off the internet where Toyota actually put less oil in the crankcase during their dyno testings to show a higher horsepower rating. Is that actually, like, is there any truth to that at all?
It kind of
caught me off guard.
No.
You know, there's an SA standard for horsepower, and cheating the horsepower, the amount of improvement that you could get wouldn't be significant enough to go out there and to make those type of changes. So, you know, quite honestly, we believe that our horsepower in our truck is sufficient. It does everything that we've asked it to do, including pulling the space shuttle. But quite honestly, as we look at the engine and do we need more horsepower, we don't believe we do. And that's why even with making efficiency changes to the engine, we haven't changed our horsepower rating, which would have been easy to do, quite honestly.
And you guys use the SAE standard for your horsepower ratings.
That is correct.
And aren't you guys the only ones who have the SAE rating for towing?
That's correct. We are the only ones compliant with SAE J2807, the towing standard, at this time. That's a little bit of a disappointment for me. So all the automakers got together and developed this standard. The idea behind that standard is to make sure that just like horsepower, we're all reporting the same numbers and the same capability of our truck. My true desire was, after that standard was written, I would really like to see us go after rear axles and front axle ratings, so that what the customer is buying, what they're seeing, what they're trying to tow with, they know that that truck is really capable of what they're asking it to do. And it really comes down to safety, in my opinion. I can't speak for my competitors why or why not they're not complying to it. But what I can say about it is that for us, we really want to focus on customer safety. We want to know the customer to know of what we say the truck can do, and they can do it safely.
Ben, we got another phone. Let's bring that in. Phone call.
Hi, guys. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio. I have a question for Mr. Swears. Let's see if I could phrase this right. Okay. It sure would be nice if Toyota had a Cummins 5-liter V8. True or false? Thank you. Good show. Bye.
Yeah, what about a diesel? Nissan's even announced they're getting a Cummins diesel.
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer a true or false question on there, but again, we look at our powertrains, we look at what our competitors are doing and where the market's going. The problem we have with diesels right now is come 2017, when the regulations for LEB 3 kick in, it's going to be very difficult for anybody to have a diesel that meets those regulations. And unless you move your trucks up to Class 2B, the 3/4-ton market, the regulations and the after-treatment systems become very expensive. So, you know, a current after-treatment system for a diesel engine costs about $3,000 on top of the engine price. And again, can the customer see a benefit, a return on that investment after they have to pay for this after-treatment system? If we had more like the European rules where you have a different standard for diesel than you do for gasoline, it would be much more feasible. And ideally, you know, we should be promoting the diesel engine in trucks because diesel engines are 30% more efficient than gasoline engines right out of the box. But it's the after-treatment systems that really make it difficult. And come 2017, I don't know how we can offer a diesel. So, you know, if we put a diesel in the trucks, how long can that engine last? And engine developments are very, very expensive.
Does Toyota have a diesel anywhere in the world?
Oh, absolutely. We sell a lot of diesels. You know, the Hilux trucks has a couple different diesel engines in it. Land Cruiser has a V8 diesel in it. In Europe, we put diesel engines in our cars. Diesel engines are popular all around the world, but in the U.S., it's really the emissions requirements that are holding diesel back.
Hey, we see more CNG and LPG fuel options on trucks. Any thought given to that?
You know, we looked at CNG. The problem with CNG is, where do you get CNG? You know, the infrastructure for that fuel isn't readily available. So it's there's kits out there. You can do it as aftermarket. We looked at doing it as OEM. But again, what is truly the customer base for it? And can the average customer, we don't make a lot of fleet sales in our trucks, and there's reasons behind it, because I'm running the plant at full capacity.
That's a good point. Yeah, because it really only makes sense for fleets right now.
That's correct.
Huh, very interesting. Hey, Ben, let's bring in another phone call here.
Hello, great show. Roger Broberg from Salt Lake City. Question for Peter. Peter, just what's your thoughts on the American Le Mans Series? Looks like they're merging with the Rolex sports car series. Just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that. I love the AMLS and kind of sorry to see it go. Thanks.
Well, actually, they're not merging. Jim France, who's obviously one of the Frances from NASCAR, bought the American Le Mans Series from Dr. Panos, and it's going to be the United Sports Car Championship beginning at Daytona in February, actually the end of January. And no one really knows what's going to happen because the ALMS P2 cars, the prototypes, were 5 seconds a lap faster than the Grand Am Daytona prototypes, which the Frances controlled. And they're supposedly going to work that out. Now, they're picking up the GT category, which was the best racing in the world for my money in the ALMS, so that will be intact. But it's the new frontier for racing. So we don't know what's going to happen. It's too bad, but having two sports car series is almost as stupid as having two IndyCar series. So.
Speaking of racing, this is somewhat related. Brian Young just wrote in to say, I read that Tom Cruise could play Carroll Shelby in the movie of the Ford-Ferrari Le Mans battle of the 60s. Your thoughts?
Huh?
I can't see Tom Cruise as Carroll Shelby.
No, I can't see Tom. I mean, you know, Carroll was still pretty dapper at that time in the 60s, but, you know, Tom just looks too young compared to what Carroll did back then.
Yeah.
I mean, Carroll was a good-looking guy back then, but that sounds weird.
I agree.
Just sounds weird.
Let's see. AAH guest 212 wants to know here, Mike, does Toyota ever utilize Hino for Tundra ideas? And, of course, Hino is Toyota Group's heavy truck maker.
That's correct. And Hino supplies parts for some of our...
Oh, no kidding. Like what?
Like the rear differential they make for us. So we use Hino. We consult with Hino engineers, looking at what they've done. And quite honestly, sometimes they help us design some of the parts in the car.
Okay, here's a tough one for you, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway. Kip says, why does Toyota even bother? They're outclassed in trucks, and they have zero chance of ever catching up. Even if the product was superior, the average redneck ain't going to buy it. Are you going to get the average rednecks buying your Tundra?
You know, when we look at our market share for Tundra, we're not trying to knock Ford off their pedestal or even challenge General Motors. I couldn't do it if I wanted to because I don't have the capacity in my plant to challenge them. So I'm not looking to be the biggest, but I do want to build the best truck. So are we getting rednecks to buy? Well, I consider myself a redneck, so yeah, I'm pretty happy with my truck. But, you know, offering the best product out there gives me some flexibility, some ability to do some things that my competition can't do. So looking at our styling of this truck, it's a little bit polarizing. It's a love-hate.
I love it.
And it's a great position
and
for us.
And I didn't like the old one,
okay,
which is interesting,
thanks.
But I like this.
Yeah, so
too soft.
Yeah, we're in a good spot because I can do things like this, and I don't have to worry about protecting 400,000 units. Right, I don't have to produce that, so it's a love hate type design. I personally love the truck, and right now the sales that are coming in, we're selling many more than we ever expected to sell. Our sales are up, and like I said, you know, our mix is much richer than we expected it to be. So we're really pleased with what we've done, and again, I don't need to challenge Ford to be there. I just need to build a great product.
And so the people in San Antonio are busy. They
The people in San Antonio are really busy right now, and they're working maximum overtime. The plant's at full capacity.
Wow.
And
wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, we're just really working hard to crank out as many trucks as possible.
We got time for one more phone call. Ben, let's bring that in.
Hi, this is Jeff Vyshek from Albany, New York. My question for the panel is, does anybody on the panel think that anybody from General Motors is going to be losing their job over the whole Peugeot-Citroën debacle and that investment going south so quickly, which pretty much I think anybody who knows anything saw that coming from a mile away? And also, how is Lieutenant Dan avoiding any criticism here, because after all, he was a captain of the ship when this deal was signed, so he should be held accountable too, I think. Thanks.
Peter?
Yeah, great question.
Well, you know, he got a promotion. He's Captain Queeg. But
and you promoted him, right?
Yeah, no, everyone else saw that the Peugeot thing was...
All of us were scratching our heads.
Yeah.
I mean, GM has a track record of failed joint relationships with Toyota, Isuzu, Suzuki, Subaru,
Fiat.
Saab, Fiat. I mean, they all ended in disaster or did nothing to move the needle for the company. And now, you know, was it a year ago they already wrote off their $400 million, kissed that goodbye. Now Peugeot is saying, you know, maybe we're not going to save so much money. And it looks like Dongfeng is, you know, the Chinese company is going to invest in them. Well, GM's tied up with Shanghai Automotive, so it looks like they might have to back out. I mean, why they went into this, I have no idea. But to the viewer's question, is anyone going to lose their job over it? I'll bet nothing happened.
No.
Nothing.
No, I expect Ackerson to leave next late spring.
I didn't recall when they had the signing of the papers and the press conference that Gursky was...
Well, Gursky was the point man on it.
Point man, yeah.
Yeah, he was the point guy on it. And remember, they brought in Thomas Neumann, who I know from when he ran the supplier company Continental, then went to Volkswagen. GM's got him now. I think he's a good guy. But, until... all the European automakers address the root cause of their problem, i.e. overcapacity and way too many people, nothing's going to get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. But why GM thought, as the largest automaker in the world, arguably, maybe Toyota, maybe Volkswagen, but certainly in the top three, why it needed another partner to achieve greater scale is beyond me. So, great question.
Because they could?
Yeah, because they could. Oh, Chip's telling me to refresh the screen here. We might have one more. Oh, yeah. Before we end the show tonight, we have to say something about Doug Guthrie, our colleague from the Detroit News, who was on the show, I want to say, a little over a month ago.
Yeah.
And in fact, Gary, he was supposed to be sitting in the very chair you're sitting in next week and died completely unexpectedly of natural causes. And it's a shock, and it's very sad to hear, because Doug is a guy who I think was a court reporter for a lot of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got this gig of being the car critic for the Detroit News, I mean, he had, like, gone to heaven. He could not believe
it. Because he'd always been a car enthusiast, and then he got, you know, so his job was covering the courts. I had a long talk with him one evening about what he was doing. I mean, and this guy was a true reporter. I mean, this guy was doing the kind of reporting that, you know, movies are made out of. And then he got the, you know, car reviewing job, and you know, he just loved it, and he just threw himself into that thing and just evinced a delight that you don't see in this thing. And I sort of thought, I had mixed feelings about it, because I thought, wow, he's such a great reporter. We need guys like that, you know, because, you know, anybody can do what we do.
But
for this guy to be going out there and, you know, doing the seamy underside and looking at that stuff, it's like, whoa. But, yeah, just a sudden thing. And he was such a great guy. I mean, he was only doing this for, I think he started... last April, I think, was his first car trip. It was, it was a Dodge Dart. And I met him there, and I drove with him and on programs, and God, the guy just loved it. And it's so sad that, you know, he's not
here.
There to be able to enjoy this dream job.
Just say nothing of his family, and I mean, it's just you know, wife and kids. And
but, so we had to say something because Doug was a friend of the show and would have been on more of these shows in the future. But anyway, we'll put that aside. Mike Swears, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Mike, and
especially for bringing the 1794 Tundra along with you. We love having vehicles in the studio.
Again, thank you for inviting me.
Gary, good to see you.
Peter, John.
Yeah.
Mike, good to see you again.
John. Yeah, good seeing you, and want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.